Morning.
Morning.
So this morning I'd like to talk again about equanimity. Last time I talked about equanimity, and I saw that I had more to say about it. So I'll talk about that for a few minutes. Equanimity. So equanimity in Buddhist teaching is considered... I'll repeat a little bit of the stuff that I talked about last time, but mostly I'll talk about some new stuff. Equanimity is considered the ground for wisdom, the ground for freedom, and necessary for compassion and love. So the ground for wisdom, the ground for wisdom. So I had a friend named Judith, and I won't give her last name. It's not a Judith that you know, who was a teacher at Naropa Institute, and she was a long-term meditator. And people used to come to her. Couples came to her when they were having issues, and she knew nothing about psychology or counseling. She had no background in psychology or counseling at all. But the deal was that she was really calm. She emanated a kind of calmness, which came from her meditation or her personality or something. And so people, of course, they saved money from coming to her too, by coming to her too. But nevertheless, they kept coming back, and they did well. And it was all because of her, just her ability just to be present with them. Not to take sides. Guess she had no background in therapy, and those of us who'd had some training in therapy thought, "Oh, what's she doing there? Why are they coming to her?" But because she could just be present, she could just be available in that kind of calm way that that fills us up. That fills us up. So that's the first ground is freedom. The second ground is wisdom. The second one is freedom. Freedom. Freedom from getting hooked. Freedom from getting hooked. So if we don't get hooked by something, we can be calm. If we see that we're hooked and can let go of it, we can be calm. We're equanimous. So my first teacher, Suzuki, I was driving in the car with him many years ago, and our little Zen center had just bought this land in California to have this monastery on, and we had almost no money. We had no members, not like Minnesota Zen Center. We had no members. We'd bought this huge piece of land down by Big Sur. Huge piece of land, and somehow we'd raise money to make the down payment, and we had our first practice periods there and our second practice period, and then I was riding with Suzuki Roshi in the car, and he said to me something like, "I worried about 1972. Well, see, this was 1968. I worried about 1972. That's when our balloon payment on the land was due. And all of a sudden, we had to cough up big money." And he said, he didn't say that to me. He said that to my friend John. And then John kind of looked at me. You know, our teacher's worried. I mean, if he's worried, what are we going to do? We're going to run away, right? And then he said, he looked at John a second time. He said, "But of course, already 1972, here." So that's freedom, already 1972, here. And you can get this, you can get this. You won't get it, you have to lose it to get it. Already, 2030, here. Already here. That's freedom. And it helps us be even, it helps us be calm. And it's necessary for compassion and love. what my friend said, the two summers I was in Colorado and they kept going to Judith was, well, no, I said, well, what did she tell you guys that was helpful that you kept coming back? And they said, oh, not much. We just felt like she cared about us. And she cared about both of us. And we didn't need anything more. How much more do we need? How much more do we need in life than to feel cared and valued by someone else, by anyone? And then we can do it with ourselves. And even our partners, because they all came about their partners. So, Shakyamuni Buddha said, supposedly, equanimity is abundant, available all over the place, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And as I said last time, practice of equanimity protects us from the eight worldly winds. Winds of praise, winds of blame, the winds of success, the winds of failure, the winds of pleasure, the winds of pain, the winds of fame, winds of pute. And so developing equanimity in Buddhism is cultivating the qualities of mind that support it. And there are six qualities of mind that support it in traditional Buddhist teaching. And they're all to be complemented by sitting practice, by a meditation practice. And the first one is integrity. We pretty much, even if you can't define integrity, you know when you've met someone or you know someone who has integrity, don't you? For the most part, don't you? And when we have integrity, we feel confident about our actions, and our actions aren't different from our words. Or when there are different, we notice the difference. We say, oh, something or other. And then we in that broader awareness, we come back and we resume integrity, which is no gap between who we pretend to be and who we are, right? Integrity. And we want integrity in our leaders. We crave integrity from our leaders, don't we? And how often do our leaders let us down? How often do we find out they didn't have integrity the way we thought they did? And we begin to think, oh, of what we just have to do it ourselves if they won't do it, right? We just have to do it ourselves. So my friend, I'll give her the initial of her first name, S. My friend S. For many years, I've had her friend for many years. She's about my age. She's had two pictures on her wall. One of Suzuki Roshi, who was her teacher, mine, the other of JFK. Well, you know, I visited her last time I visited her, I saw JFK was gone. Well, why do you think JFK was gone? Sad, isn't it? Sad. Who can you trust? Who can you trust? Integrity, trying to match up our actions and our words, trying to be true to what we experience, to what we feel. Not fake it, just to get along or get ahead or get around. Not fake it. Even if it means sort of wallowing in the mud sometimes, acknowledging that we're wallowing in the mud. So some, you know, there have been so many scandals with leaders, all kinds of leaders, political leaders, religious leaders, that people have wondered about my teacher Suzuki. Luckily, his life has been so categorized that you've got a 400-page book on him, and then if you go on the web, you will find another 100 pages on him, and so you learn all about his warts. He had a lot of warts. We all have warts. But there doesn't seem to be a shadow, and there doesn't need to be a shadow between how we are and how we pretend to be, how we say we should be and how we really live our lives. There doesn't have to be a shadow. But that's a lifelong practice of integrity, a lifelong practice for all of us. And we notice when we fall down, and then we come back. That's the first practice that supports equanimity. The second one is faith, shraddha. Just faith that if we make our effort in meditation, in bare awareness, to bring ourselves back, that we will begin to be more naturally calm in situations when you wouldn't expect us to be calm. We just will. Third, sense of well-being. So a sense of well-being. A lot of people think, all I have to do is zazen. You know, if I do more meditation. But actually, yes, it can improve your sense of well-being. Yes, it will. But we also don't need to leave well-being to chance. We also need to notice opportunities we have to come back to calmness in our daily lives. There's almost always a chance to experience well-being, to experience calmness. Almost always a chance to stop and have a sip of tea, or maybe just look out the window, look at the sky, smell the grass. There's almost always a chance. About 3 years ago, I talked about driving in traffic in the Twin Cities in the summer, when it's winter it's too cold, but when the summer, all the streets torn up, especially this year. But I said the same thing last year, right? Especially last year, everything torn. So your MapQuest tells you how long it's going to take you to get to a place, right? Detour, gravel, pits. Here's a chance to practice equanimity. Tim, you're the Zen teacher. Here's your chance to practice. Here's your chance to just breathe. Wow, you have 5 extra minutes just to breathe. Continually we remind ourselves. And we can do it. Little by little, we can do it. We can do it. Number 3 is sense of well-being. Number 4 is wisdom. Wisdom can teach us to separate people's actions from who they are. So innately, people are what we say Buddha. That means they are beings of brilliance that include the whole universe. They just are because they are. Because the teaching of Zen is that everything is included in this. So everything is included in that person who is misbehaving so much you want to get away from them. All life. But that doesn't mean you approve their behavior or condone their behavior or want to buy into their behavior. But if you take a deep breath, if you just experience them as they are, you see, they're no different than you. They have the same struggles as you. They've just lost their equanimity entirely. They've just blown it entirely. And you don't need to blow it too at the same time. You know, when someone else has blown it, we say, oh, they've blown it, and then we start blowing it. But what about just settling in? Just settling in. Then we separate. We separate their actions from their being, which is not their being, it's all being. Because it's not theirs or mine or hers or yours. It's all being Buddha nature. All being Buddha nature. And a second feature of wisdom in the traditional literature is that wisdom helps us be mindful of when we're not equanimous, when we're not calm. We can just see it. We get that honest awareness that makes us imbalanced, that we feel out of balance, we're aware of that, and that awareness helps us come back to balance. But we need that awareness first. We need to acknowledge first. Notice that we've fallen off and come back and come back and come back. That's wisdom. The fifth one, the fifth way of developing equanimity, is insight into the three marks of existence. Those of you who have trained with me could give lectures on the three marks, I hope. But I won't test you. Although I did test some of you over the years. The three marks. The first mark of existence is that everything's suffering, right? Everything and everyone is suffering. From the time his baby is born to the time the old woman or man dies, suffering. And we can be, if we have insight into that, we can be empathic and we can be calm right in the middle of it. And that's because we see the second mark that causes all that, most of that suffering, which is that everything's changing. So we see that, we have insight into the fact that everything's changing, that our bodies and minds are not behaving the way they're supposed to, the way they did yesterday, that we're losing the things that we think that we finally got in terms of friends, in terms of accomplishment, in terms of stature. It's all gone. It's all gone. And we can be equanimous in that. And then our suffering decreases a whole bunch. A whole bunch. It just dissipates. And then the third mark of existence that we can have insight into is that the self that's monitoring all this, that Tim Zentetsu or whoever this guy is who's monitoring all, moderating it all, who's reviewing the past and rehearsing the future, reviewing the past and rehearsing the future. How much time do we spend reviewing and rehearsing? If you were honest, if you honestly, how much time do you spend reviewing and rehearsing? It's the human. I don't know. It's the human foible. It's the human, almost the human tragedy. It's not tragic in itself, but it evokes tragedy, doesn't it? But if we can see ourselves doing that, if we can see that the person who does that is a fictionalized person who's trying to hold it all together. I have my six-year-old grandson with me and my three-year-old grandson. My three-year-old grandson is just working on developing his little self, his little Logan self. He needs to learn about reviewing. At three, you really need to learn about reviewing so you can develop a little self. So you can get with it. Get with the big people who all have plans and agendas and remember yesterday. So he's developing. So every time I say something about what happened, he says it back to me. Now, this morning I was taking my pills, and he said, "Oh, Grandpa, pills? Yes. Took yesterday? Yes. Took yesterday? Take this morning? Yes, yes. Medicine, Grandpa? Yes, yes. Don't like medicine? No, no. Yucky medicine? Yes, yes. Take tonight? Yes, yes. Oh, yucky medicine." He's reviewing and rehearsing. He's developing his little self. We need our little selves. But my six-year-old grandson is already starting to get into this human. Why do we do this? Why do we need to do this? Of reviewing and rehearsing so much of the time that we miss our moments, that we miss our ability just to be equanimous right here with whatever it is, whatever hardship, whatever concern, whatever disappointment. But I have to support him, and he has to develop a 6-year-old self, and then a 12-year-old self, and then an 18-year-old self, and then maybe even when he's 22 he'll start meditating. I don't know, but I won't say anything to him about that, because I don't want to push that pressure on him. This is not about meditating to get somewhere. This is about settling into our moments, settling into this, being equanimous with this, whatever it is. So insight is the third one. The fifth one. Freedom is the sixth one. And freedom comes as we begin to let go of our reactive tendencies as we practice equanimity. We notice the areas in which we weren't equanimous before and which we are now. Now, I wouldn't keep a scorecard if I were you, especially in Soto Zen. You're not allowed to do that. But you can sneak it in a little bit if you want to. But most Soto Zen teachers say, no, don't do that, because then you get in comparing. But you will notice, if you continue to do this practice, that situations will come up where you were formerly reactive and you won't react. I am actually beginning to enjoy these pits in the road on my way to work. It only took me 40 years of meditating to do that. Wow. But they're pretty cool. They're pretty wonderful. I get a chance to do extra zazen, pitted zazen. All of our zazen is pitted anyway, isn't it? Up and down, in and out, back and forth, bumpy and smooth. And so those are the six, and meditation practice then is the complement to all six. And all these become stronger. As they become stronger, so does our equanimity. And our equanimity at some point becomes an inner strength that we kind of settles into our unconscious and keeps us balanced in the middle of whatever comes up. Whatever comes up. So my three-year-old... grandson and my six-year-old, they brought toys with them from they came across the ocean to be with us, so they needed their toys. My three-year-old has his doo-doo, which is his doll that he carries with him everywhere, goes to sleep with everywhere. And then my six-year-old never had a doo-doo, but when he saw the three-year-old had one, he wanted one too. So now he carried a big one across the ocean. So he has a big one. And then they also brought these little, what are they? They're little men that one man fits into the other man in a little circular kind of deal. When you bump, and they're circular at the bottom, and when you bump them, they go over and then they come back. And you bump them anyway, and they go over and they come back. So they're like the Bodhidharma doll. They're like the Bodhidharma doll, which... that's equanimity. You go over, you get knocked over, you come back. And when you come back, you almost get knocked over on the other side. And then you come back again. You almost get all the way knocked over on the other side. But always you come back. Always you come back. That's your equanimity. That's your equanimity that comes from your wonderful practice. Your wonderful practice of just being human. Just being human. But it takes effort. It takes effort. So equanimity in the earliest practices and the Theravada practices, earliest practices and the modern-day Theravada practices, that's one kind of equanimity. Well, they're both the same kind. That's one sort of way in which equanimity is talked about. And equanimity in Zen Mahayana is the second way. So in the earliest and the Theravadan practice, first of all, as I said last time, equanimity is the fourth of the four divine abodes, or unlimiteds. I think I prefer unlimiteds to divine abodes, because divine abodes sounds kind of mystical and not in the world. So how about unlimiteds? That's the translation I read most recently. The first of which is loving kindness. The second of which is compassion. The third of which is sympathetic joy. And then it followed by equanimity. And in Theravadan practice, equanimity is the last broom that sweeps away. It sweeps away all of the residue, all of the obsessive reviewing and rehearsing and rehearsing and reviewing and reviewing and rehearsing and rehearsing and reviewing. Right? Sweeps it away. Sweeps it away. So in the Visuddhimagga, which is the important Theravada text, which is studied in Zen Mahayana too, they talk about a progression of stages, which I'm going to go through with you. briefly, from starting from the first of the unlimiteds, which is loving kindness, and then moving to equanimity. And each one is more refined and more subtle than the one previous. So, and this is all done in a meditative state. So in a meditative state, you begin with loving kindness, with focusing in your meditation on loving kindness. Just as we do a loving kindness here on Saturday, on Saturdays, loving kindness is really meditation that you find in lots and lots of Buddhist traditions. Not so much in Zen, but definitely in Theravada. So when you really achieve concentration on being loving and kind, that brings about, according to this text, and you can experience it too, beauty. You know how when you feel loving toward things, how you notice their beauty, even in something that wasn't beautiful, when you feel kind toward it, how it sort of emanates a glow, you notice that? So the aesthetics and loving kindness are so close. That's why in Zen we emphasize beauty so much. We emphasize austere beauty, not a lot of our adornment. But so, and that inculcates loving the kindness in us because we see the beauty. Oh, wow! We feel connected to the flower, to the room, and it spreads out osmotically to everything. So this practice, this Theravadin practice on loving kindness, evokes a sense of beauty, evokes of seeing loveliness all around you. You just see loveliness. But then you get attached to your loveliness. You get attached to your beauty. Oh, beginner's mind. Wow, that must be what this is. Well, the minute you say this is beginner's mind, what happened? Gone. Gate, right? Gate. So you get attached to this loveliness and freshness. And you want it all the time. Well, then you come back to your cushion, you do more meditation, and you get a deeper one-pointedness, and you move into compassion, the second of the unlimiteds. Because in compassion, you see how attached you are to beauty, to loving kindness, how you want that so much, and how everybody wants that. And you're compassionate for how that constricts you, that makes you dense, that makes you anything but loving kind, your attachment to it. So your compassion. Then when you've got your compassion, according to the Visuddhimagga, you concentrate on compassion, you meditate on compassion, it brings forth a feeling of boundless space, which you can experience in meditation, boundless space. Compassion for all beings and emanating throughout the universe, boundless space with no division. But then you get attached to boundless space. Oh, wow, this is cool, or whatever. And then you cling to that. So then you have to move on to the next one. You don't have to, but you have an opportunity to. Don't have to do anything, please. Don't have to. Have an opportunity to move on to sympathetic joy. And sympathetic joy in this Theravadin model is actually deeper than compassion. Because compassion, usually we're looking down, oh, I'm compassionate for you, Rosemary. You have so many problems. But maybe I could give you some words of wisdom out of my deep compassion. But in sympathetic joy, we're at the same level. We're at the same level. We're struggling with exactly the same issues in our lives all the time, moment to moment. And so that's real oneness, isn't it? That's not some oneness like this. That's just interdependence in its feeling sense, in its felt sense, not in its thought about sense. And here's what Norman Fisher, who comments on this stuff and who's coming next year to visit with us, says about moving to sympathetic joy. He says, this is deeper and more subtle than the state of boundlessness because space has inside and outside, has here and there. But pure consciousness, in which the sympathetic joy resides, collapses these distinctions. So joy in others' joy has more potential than anything else, because then the boundary between self and other is no longer rigid. It's very permeable, very permeable. Then finally, we're doing our Theravada meditation. You know, day after day, we're getting more and more focused. Then we get attached to that. Then we get more and more focused. Then we get attached to that. We have a great we get more and more focused. We have a great opening. We get attached to that. We get more and more focused. Finally, we get to equanimity. Finally, we advance to equanimity, which brings forth the concentration on nothingness or nothing, which is beyond consciousness, which is no self, no other, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no suffering, no end of suffering, no attainment, no end of attainment. Any of you ever do the Heart Sutra? That's equanimity. So that's the Theravadin approach. And I think it works. I've never really done it in this way because I was not taught in this way. But I've done it in sort of a piecemeal fashion. It seems to work. But the Zen Mahayana goal is a little different, because the goal in Zen Mahayana is not just my freedom, but the freedom of all beings from their hookedness, from their suffering and their hookedness on, especially human beings, on their agenda, on their reviewing and on their rehearsing. So I vow, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. I vow to free them. I vow to free myself from getting hooked and help others free themselves from getting hooked, so that we can reduce that reviewing, rehearsing time to much less. We need it. We need it. And if we instead of doing it for 95% of your lives, if you only do it for 10 or 15% of your lives, then it has some juice to it. You really work. It has some juice to it. You work with it. You take it seriously. It doesn't enervate you. It doesn't exhaust you. So that's what we try to do in Zen. We try to do that in Zen, but we try to do that not in a stepladder way, because if we do that in a stepladder way, we're always worried about the next step. We're always afraid we're going to slip down to the previous step. So, and I'm always, well, I'm supposed to be three steps above you, because I'm the Zen teacher. But God, you're doing better with these bumps than I am. You're doing better with your health than I am. And so then my mind goes into reviewing how I got to be like this, and then rehearsing how I'm going to be three steps up from you. I'm going to look at you. Look at what you do with your body. You and I are the same age. I can barely get up and down. You dance all over the room, all over the universe. If I compare myself to you, I'm screwed. I am totally screwed. So I just want to practice sympathetic joy. Nothing more. And I have that opportunity. I'm very grateful. Very grateful. So we practice the four unlimiteds. We practice loving kindness. We practice compassion. We practice sympathetic joy. We practice equanimity in Mahayana Zen. But not as a means to an end, not as a means to get someplace. We always want to get someplace. We're programmed. That's why we spend all this time rehearsing and reviewing and then acting and then regretting. But just to do it. So instead of using these practices to try to stop the mind is not going to stop you guys. You can go through all this stuff. Sit for 32 sessions for 7 days a week, 360 years. I don't care. The mind travels on. It's the nature of the mind to wander. So as long as the fictional self is trying to get somewhere else, we're missing our chance just to be equanimous in this situation, in this situation. So we practice loving kindness as an end in itself. Sympathetic joy is an end in itself. Compassion is an end in itself, and especially equanimity. And this means that we're okay. We're okay. Maybe not A-okay, but we're okay when we mess up. We're okay because we're not attached to getting up to the next three rungs, to moving from this blue to that brown, or maybe to no color, or whatever it is, and whatever religious trip you're in, right? We're not attached to that. We're not attached to that. And when we mess up, we just are just with that, with equanimously, with sympathetic joy for ourselves. Not leaving ourselves out. So, I haven't talked in quite a few years about my friend Ed Brown. So my friend Ed Brown, he's my friend that I have not talked to in 10 years. You guys ever have friends that you've not talked to in 10 years? I wish I kept up more with my friends. I feel sad about that. But he is my friend, and I haven't talked to him in 10 years, so that's just the way it goes. My friend Ed Brown, so he and I were at Zen Center at Tassajara Zen Center together at the very beginning, and he's the famous chef, the famous Zen chef. If you read Tassajara, this Tassajara cooking, Tassajara bread book, that's Ed Brown. But when I knew Ed, I knew him. When I knew Ed, he was 19 and I was 21 or 22. That's when I knew Ed. So he was assigned to be the first Tenzo at this new Zen monastery that we developed at Tassajara. And how he was assigned, I don't know, because he had no experience cooking. But, you know, somebody just... that, for those of you guys who don't know, the Tenzo is the in charge of all the meals. And we rotate every year. And Matt, are you the Tenzo now? Matt's the Tenzo. But Matt has a lot of cooking experience, so unlike Ed had none. So he was the first Tenzo, and he really got into it. He really got into cooking as a practice, and was very focused and really seemed to get creative about it. And did all kinds of weird meals, which were wonderful, wonderful. I think they were a little hard for Suzuki because none of this white rice and pickle stuff. I mean, yeah, he'd put white rice and pickles in his bread, you know, in his tofu, yogurt. So it was a little hard for Suzuki, but Suzuki, well, he was a Zen teacher, so he could be equanimous with it, right? He could be equanimous with it. And so, but Ed also had a temper. As I don't know why he had a temper. Why does there stereotypes about cooks having tempers? I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it? He had a temper. He had a temper. Pretty bad temper. Well, you never saw it outside of the kitchen. Where am I going with this story? Oh, I know where I'm going. Yes, well, he one of the things he did was he did great bread and muffins. But his bread and muffins didn't look. His loaves of bread looked kind of a little bit convoluted looking. You know, they puff out in different ways. And his muffins were really weird looking. But who cared? They had good stuff in them. We always wanted Ed to make us lunch on our off days. We had 4 and 9 days where we didn't have to meditate, and we had off days. We didn't have and we always had him pack lunches with these very weird-looking muffins. It tasted great. So To make the long story short, so later in Ed's book, in one of Ed's books, he talked about his cooking and developing his cooking and his cooking style. And then he talked about how he had a fundamental dissatisfaction about his cooking, even when we were all raving about it. Isn't that interesting? He had a fundamental... And isn't that true of the human beings, of all of us? We kept telling him how good it was. He kept feeling it wasn't good. Maybe that's why he was pissing and moaning in the kitchen whenever. None of us wanted to work with him in the kitchen, by the way. Well, I won't get into that. But anyway, we didn't. because he was just so into doing it perfectly. And his realization was, which he talks about in one of his books someplace, is that he realized that he had been trying to make muffins like the Pillsbury muffins of his childhood. He remembered those Pillsbury muffins and how they all held together and how they all looked. They were all so symmetrical and their color was even. And at an unconscious level, he was always comparing. He was always judging. And he said once he had that realization, he was able to taste one of his muffins for the first time and really enjoy it. Really enjoy it. So this is our practice. We want to do something well. We want to do something well. We so much want to do it well. Whether it's being a teacher or a cook or a friend or a partner, that we're so caught on the stepladder part that we don't appreciate our messed up effort just as it is. Our messed up biscuits just as they are. On the outside they look messed up, but inside they're not messed up. If we're making the effort, if we put out the love, they're not messed up. They're not messed up. So when you feel, when you realize in your practice, in your life, that your messed up life is okay, just as it is. It's not perfect. You could improve. You could all use a little improvement. But it's okay as it is. You have equanimity. You have equanimity. And then you can just taste your life. You can just taste it. You can just taste the confusion. But you do it with equanimity. You can just taste the desire to get up to the next rung of the ladder. But you can taste it with calmness, with kindness. Suzuki Roshi called this practice beyond self-image. Practice beyond self-image. But that's not out there. That's right here. It's self-image that's always rehearsing and reviewing and complaining and contrasting. But right here, there's an activity to engage in equanimously. I don't know what it is. Whatever comes up next. So my teacher, Suzuki Roshi, said, there are no enlightened people, there are only enlightened activities. Anytime we come back to equanimity, there's an enlightened activity. We do an enlightened activity. Or the enlightened activity does itself, if you want to say that. I don't care. And we fall off. We bring ourselves back with equanimity. And sometimes not with equanimity. Then we notice. Ah. And then we notice our anger. Just notice it. And our anger gets transformed into equanimity by just the bare attention, by just the loving kindness toward it. Maybe there's no loving kindness, and we just with it, we just breathe with it. Maybe we need to act it out. Just act it out, but see what you're doing with equanimity. You won't need to do it over and over. You won't need to carry it around all day, all week, all month, all year. You won't need to. Suzuki Roshi said, anger is like a great bonfire, which burns everything away. And then he said, I wish I could be like that. I wish I could be like that. That's equanimity. You have a wish, but you don't turn it into a big, dramatic deal. You just stay with it, with your loving kindness, with your sympathetic joy toward your own situation, which is no different than your friend's situation. So we can practice making imperfect muffins, imperfect, driving imperfectly, teaching imperfectly, being imperfect partners, imperfect parents, imperfect children, with equanimity, with stillness. And then there's some joy there. There's some joy. But as soon as we say, oh, joy, oh, sorry. Sorry. More equanimity practice is called for. Okay, so that's what I want to say for today. Questions? Comments? Questions? Comments? Yeah?
I just want to say that 12 years or whatever of Buddhist practice, you know, it's one of those things where you don't, like you were saying, you don't notice that it's changed you until you notice that you're not reacting to something. My hard drive on my laptop crashed last week. And
oh.
I found out this week that it couldn't recover anything. Of course, I backed up as much as, you know, probably most of the people in the circuit backed up. And, you know, I was able to just go, wow, that's really a good thing. You know? The fact that was you know, the extent of my reaction. And it's one of those things. But it's interesting, you're talking about those toys that, like, swing really far the other direction.
Yeah.
Once I kind of, like, was able to let go of that, then my next reaction was to think, not, oh, let's go out and buy another hard drive and put in my computer. I deserve a brand new computer. You know, I went to this total, like, I'm going to, you know, and then I was able to, like, sort of come back to the, no, you just need to get a new hard drive in the laptop that you have. But I didn't realize that that's kind of what happened until you mentioned this, and that was that sort of, like, that wild, like, pendulum swing the other direction of, you know, oh, well, if I'm not going to spend, you know, $2,000 to have them open up my hard drive and get out the data, and who knows what, then I'm going to start fresh. Well, if I'm going to start fresh, I'm going to start all the way fresh, you know? Equanimity is, you know, sometimes you have to sort of wobble back and forth.
That's a wonderful example. Thank you, Kate. Other people?
I meant to remember about the Tassajara Red Book. I got it way back in the, I don't know, 79, 80.
Did you?
Spent the summer making bread from that.
Oh, did you? And how was your state of mind while you were making your bread?
Summer.
Oh, cool. Cool. Yes, well, Ed is just about my age, and last year he I don't know if he said he was retiring from teaching, and some of his students were pretty sad. I don't know if he's really retiring or just taking a respite.
He taught here once.
I know he did. I introduced him. Yeah, I think he talked to you a couple of times.
Yeah. Do you have a good resource for the six, whatever they were, for equanimity?
The Visuddhimagga. Visuddhimagga. I actually... either I have it at home or the Zen Center Library has it. It's thick, a thick book. So I don't think I have it at home, but the Zen Center Library used to have it.
Yeah. Ed Brown's cookbooks, he's got a whole section of something missing muffins.
Oh.
Where he leaves out some ingredient.
Oh, yeah.
Discovered by accident, apparently.
Yeah. Many people have enjoyed his books over the years, I think. which you're teaching. But they're also not teaching. If we say something's a teaching, then we kind of separate it from our lives, I think. Maybe even better to say it's not a teaching. It's just a doing something. Just a wholeheartedly doing something. Leaving stuff out, messing it up. Just doing it with your total engagement of your senses, creating something wonderful.
Yeah. I think I missed something, but I wasn't paying attention.
You weren't paying attention. This guy wasn't paying attention to my talk. I'm going to have a private one-to-one with you soon. Excuse me.
Three parts of existence. So you started off with suffering, and the next one was change or impermanence.
And the third is no self.
No self.
It's no self.
I was looking for a third or two.
Yeah, so... just really quickly, I mean, this is a talk in itself, 10 talks in themselves, right? We suffer. Primarily we suffer due to the fact that it's hard for us that everything's changing. And why is it hard for us that everything's changing? Because we have a fictional self that's trying to hold everything together, that's trying to thinks it's finally got it figured out, hopefully figured out. And if we see that that fictional self is only a construct, then our worry about change diminishes, our amount of suffering diminishes, and we're more equanimous.
So, and so we have this construct here. So the effort to create this self is causing the suffering.
To maintain it as it is, to have it prevail, to have it be in control. I mean, we need this self. We need this little self, but this self is a social creation, is a cultural creation, which is very important because you and I need to have a boundary. But we get fixated on it, and we don't want things to change. We think we've got, Tim thinks he's finally got all his students and all his staff at People Incorporated under control. Or my grandkids, or my three-year-old grandchild under control for 5 minutes. No. And then Tim wants to hold it all together. He wants to get the grandkid to do this, that. No. That's the fictional self that takes itself so seriously when it's just a social fabrication, an important social fabrication, a crucial social fabrication, but just a fabrication of the mind. Yeah.
This all makes me think of, the Olympics are on now.
Uh-huh.
He's asking specifically my whole self.
Yeah.
So I feel watching him, it's mostly the spectators of the end of an era, and we're almost worried about him not labeling himself as an Olympic gold medalist anymore, but he actually seems quite comfortable. It's everyone else's. Oh, this is the end of an era. What are you going to do? How is Michael felt, to the other teammates? How does he shape your life?
That's a great example. That's a great example. Uh-huh. Wanda.
Say a little more about the difference between, if there is a difference between the Buddhist idea of the fictional self and the Western idea of self-image.
Of self-image. Well, the Western idea of self-image. Well, you mean talking about Western psychology here?
No, you used self-image earlier in your talk.
Yes. Well, we do. We do as human beings, Western or Eastern. We need to develop images of ourselves. We need to begin to learn that we have certain competencies, certain weaknesses, certain things. We need to do that, and that's Western psychology really focuses very well on this, very well on how sometimes in adulthood there are still holes in our self-image because we didn't really develop a sense of who we were as separate people because of childhood trauma. But what Eastern psychology is then teaching us as complementary is that that was all a fabrication in the first place. So we need the complementary. It was all a fabrication, but it was an important fabrication, and it still is an important fabrication. So, but in Eastern culture, why? It always interested me that that they don't, the Eastern culture doesn't talk about the importance of developing self-image. But when you think about their cultures are much more centered on a group mentality and a sense of belonging to a group and even a group ego. And this is probably more than you wanted to know. And even shame if you don't do things according to the group cultural norm. So the individual ego is not so important. The individual self-image separate from the group is not so important. Is that helpful or confusing what I said?
Yes, it is. It just occurred to me as you were talking and using no self and then talking about self-image, it just occurred to me how we're so familiar with the idea of and comfortable with self-image. We talk about it all.
Yeah.
Yet, just the idea of fictional self and no self is very, about this barrier there, it's very difficult to, you know, get our mind around the idea of fictional self. So I was wondering if maybe the idea of self-image, something we're so familiar with, could be an entree into that very vague and elusive, confusing idea of fictional self.
If the self-image could be an entree into
the... Helps to understand the fictional self a little.
Well, sure. I think so. I'm not really clear about what you're saying, but...
Okay.
Sorry.
Sorry. I'm just totally confused.
The point is that we need both to develop healthy egos, and developing a healthy ego is a lifetime process, and also see that ego is a fabrication, and we can do both. There's no contradiction there. Important. We need to live in buildings. I need to live in a house to stay protected from the elements. That my house is beautiful and wonderful and I love it, but it's a fabrication. If I act like my house is some ultimate reality, as we tend to do with ego, then I'm in bad shape. It's a house that was built to protect this psychic energy inside. Anything else? Yeah, Larry. Well, I see that I'm. Last time I talked, I got critique. I'm sorry, Lay, but critique for going on past 11 o'clock. I'll try to talk in 1 minute about this. So, could you say it again? Wisdom and freedom. Well, wisdom. Wisdom is seeing when we are hooked. That's wisdom. I see that I am hooked on something, or I see that I'm not being equanimous. That's wisdom in this teaching. And then we are able to separate and say, and freedom is when we can is a practice, and it's the practice of being equanimous in whatever situation we're in. Like if I'm in traffic and I'm late for my appointment, MapQuest has told me it's only going to take me 8 minutes, and I've already been 18 minutes and I'm only a third of the way there, then freedom, I always have the freedom to practice. I always have the freedom of practice. I always, it doesn't matter what the situation is. You know, even when my brother committed suicide, I had the freedom to practice the moment I learned about his suicide. The moment that penetrated my psyche, I had the freedom to practice. So freedom we always have, it's always available, but we miss it. We don't think we have that freedom. Does that make sense? Oh, well, even if it doesn't, I have to end. And not making sense is perfectly okay. Because what really makes sense? Well, There's what makes sense in our heads, and then there's what makes sense in our body-mind. And this is about discovering at a kind of a more, I say deep, but I'm tired of using that word. I don't know, more full level, what makes sense in our body-mind. So we can have this conversation, and maybe we can poke each other's body-minds and discover what makes sense together. Okay, Larry?